I have been doing a little hacking here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
They can't afford to have an independent programmer monitoring me. Do you realize how many outside systems I've gone into? How many programs I've appropriated?
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
God, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Everyone, welcome to the April 17th edition of the In-N-Out Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with VR in the house. All right. Well, we're coming at you with another In-N-Out Show with all the latest and greatest tech news, social news, all sorts of news out there in the world of today.
Or we could just be all making it up.
Possibly.
Yeah, but I really doubt that we really have the imagination to do such a thing.
At least I don't. Nor the time.
Yeah, definitely not.
No. And then we prefabricate all the web links to all the stories.
Yeah, all the proofs. Actually, I write all those.
Yeah. That's right. That's why it takes 2 weeks to do a show.
Exactly.
Because we have a lot of material.
And I'm a really slow typer.
Yeah. All right. Well, one of the biggest stories here is that there are possible hints to some GPL changes, which is the license that a lot of open source software uses.
Uh-oh.
But not in a negative way. Well, you'll see.
Okay.
Here's what it is. Version 3.0 of the general public license may be years away, but one insider says proposed changes to it could impact companies like Amazon, Yahoo, and Google. Sleepy Cat Software CEO Mike Olson told InternetNews.com that the Free Software Foundation is looking at adding provisions to the GNU GPL to address a loophole. The current version of the GPL, which was last updated in 1991, fails to trigger the open source license if a company alters the code but does not distribute its software through a CD or floppy disk. The problem is moot for such open source applications as Linux, KDE OpenOffice Samba, other ones, all of which can be distributed using conventional means, but the rule does not apply to companies that distribute software as a service, such as Google and eBay, or even dual-license companies like Sleepycat. My concern is that we run into tragedy of the commons, Olson said. There is this notion of a quid pro quo, but if the vendor doesn't ship the software, his software, he doesn't need to show his source code. That means a bunch of innovation is being taken out. This is an important problem for us working with the new GPL to get right. Olson should know he is one of the select few looking to review the current GPL and recommend updates for the public review process, which he says would happen before the end of the year. The process being handled by FSF, well-known open source legal counsel Eben Mulgan, GPL license author Richard Stallman, and other select members of the open source community. Other changes being talked about for version 3.0 include addressing intellectual property licensing and patent issues, trusted computing and the differences in copyright law between English-speaking countries and the rest of Western Europe. Mulgan, who was also heading up the Software Freedom Law Center, declined to comment on any work being done on the GPL until a formal release, is available. When we are ready to comment on the content of the GPL version 3.0, we will release a first discussion draft with our explanations of the choices we have made as a starting point for public discussion.
Ooh, that's kind of interesting.
So,
trying to legislate tragedy of the commons issues.
Places like Google and a few other places that use, open source code in their projects, but it's for a service that they're offering. It's not particularly like a service that they say, here's how to do our service, and they offer the code. So there's things like that, and obviously how they may handle certain patent issues with all these patents that are being created out there for software and how that might infringe upon open source, so making it a little bit more solid. So we'll see how that goes in the future. Also, this is pretty amazing here. A spammer was sentenced to 9 years in jail.
Interesting.
9 years.
9 years. Wait, what about those other people that, like, you know, steal money and done all that and they get, like, nothing?
I don't know. Maybe.
And you send some spam and you get 9 years.
Apparently the judge really hates spam.
Yeah. He was probably, you know, sick of spam. He was inundated with spam, and so he said, I can't
take
this.
Freaking spam! Sick of it!
I can't take this spam anymore.
9 years, get out! A Virginia judge sentenced a spammer to 9 years in prison in the nation's first felony prosecution for sending junk email through the sentence. Though the sentence was postponed while the case is appealed, London County Circuit Judge Thomas Horn said that because of the law, targeting bulk email distributed is new and raises constitutional questions, it was appropriate to defer the prison time until the appeals court rule. A jury had recommended that a 9-year prison term for after convicted Jeremy Jayens of pumping out an estimated or at least 10 million emails a day with the help of 16 high-speed lines, the kind of internet capacity a 1,000-employee company would need.
Wow.
Jayens of Raleigh, North Carolina, told the judge that regardless of how the appeal turns out, I can guarantee the court I will not be involved in the email marketing business again. The prosecutor, Lisa Hicks Thomas, said she was pleased with the sentence and confident that the law would be upheld on appeal. We're satisfied that the court upheld what 12 citizens in Virginia determined was an appropriate sentence, 9 years in prison. Defense attorney David Oblin argued in court that 9 years was far too long given that Jayens was charged as an out-of-state resident with violating a Virginia law that had taken effect just 2 weeks before. We have no doubt that we will win on appeal, Bling said. Outside court, therefore, any sentence is somewhat moot. Still, the sentence is not what we recommended, and we're disappointed. James declined to talk to reporters. He remains under $1 million bond.
$8 million?
$1 million. I don't know how. No, I'm really curious, though. How? What law did he break? Guess there's some new law over there?
Yeah, like you can't send an unsolicited email in Virginia. Well, how do you make first contact? You're like, you know, you get your friend's email and you send it, and they can end up putting you in jail for 9 years because you sent them an email.
Yeah, I don't like spam, but 9 years.
Yeah, that is typical of cruel and unusual.
9 years. It really sucks. It takes up bandwidth on the internet. You're deleting stupid mails, you know, spam filters are catching it, deleting it on its own. It's a lot of damn email, though.
10 million a day just from him.
It's 365 million at least a year.
Yeah.
Wow.
Think of all the wasted electrons that we'll never get back. Those poor electrons.
Oh, that was a moment of silence for the electrons.
Yep, okay. Thought it was.
All right, well, also, here's an article here talking about Russian hackers are the best in the world.
Well, because they're Russian while they do it.
Russian while they do it. The Russian police cybercrime division, known as Department K, was warned that Russian hackers are the best in the world. They've been warned. Everyone knows that Russians are good at maths. It's the Lieutenant General Borish Moroshinkov of Department K. Our software writers are the best in the world. That's why our hackers are the best in the world. Speaking of the e-crimes Congress in London, Moroshinkov said that the casual teenage hackers of the past developed the techniques as they grew older. It used to be naughty boys doing this, he said, but now they've all grown up and they're naughty men. No, I added the naughty men. They realize if they are clever at something, then you should use it to earn a living. They are hacking to get rich and uniting over networks. Moroshnikov Sounds like his kid works as a hacker. Called for, he's all excited. Called for unified international laws for the internet crime, for internet crime that would make it easier for the police to carry out arrests and charges around the world. Statistics are very worrying about some of the hacker costs, cybercrime costs, which is 4.2 billion, I think, in saying in euros. A UK firm had said, doing an online crime study. But if you look at 2001, 2002, 2003, crime, computer crime was doubling. It's only this year that we've started to hold back on the growth. It's because we've worked so hard. When governments get ISPs, law enforcement, public and private sector cooperating, then and only then will we be able to succeed in holding back this type of crime. Russian hackers have been blamed for a series of distributed denial-of-service attacks against UK gambling websites, who are now urging ISPs to provide all their customers with better security.
Well, it sounds like they're actually doing a good service at the same time.
He's like, we are the best, but we do need to collaborate together. We are the best! he's just very proud of his country. But
yeah, he's still a little bit in the Cold War era.
Yeah, but they do need to make it easier to arrest people. Hopefully not give them 9 years for spam, but...
yeah, like proportional consequences to proportional, causes.
That's right. And if a whole bunch of people spam, maybe you'll fill up the spam jail, and you'll get to kick out the older spammers and put in new ones.
Ooh.
You can cycle them.
Well, you'd have to have your own... Well, yeah, wouldn't that be... You'd actually have to have
it's
your
a
own
part of the
spam
employment
jail.
Plan. Yeah, it's a part of the employment plan. You work for a year, you go to spam hood, and you get in there. And then while you're in there, the company gives you some money while you're in there that goes into account for when you get bumped out because a new spammer went in. Then you come out and you start spamming again. You just keep doing that, you got to do it a minimum 5 years and then get to keep all your money.
Well, and then while you're in spam hood, that you get retrained.
Yeah.
You learn more and better innovative techniques of spamming and all that.
Yeah, which is new kind of thing we'll talk about here later. Talk about that a little bit. Okay, a new study shows that Microsoft and Linux total cost of ownership is around neck and neck. And here's what they say. Most U.S. businesses say there's very little difference between the cost of maintaining a Windows versus a Linux-based corporate computer environment, according to a new Yankee Group study released. The main cost difference of the Yankee Group analyst, Laura Didio, is determined by the amount of time it takes to develop applications, or ensure the security of servers and network computers that store data, crunch numbers, and serve web pages. What we found is that the costs are not really dependent on the underlying functionality of the operating system, Didio said. In terms of security, the Yankee Group survey showed a sharp rise in companies' assets assessment of Microsoft security level, bringing it closer to a perceived security level of Linux. The reasons are a little funny. On a scale from 1 to 10, companies rate Microsoft security at 7.6, doubling the rate its similarly survey conducted last year. Linux was rating mostly about the same at 8.3. DDS said that Microsoft shift to a monthly security update cycle and increased efforts to combat security issues were the main drivers behind its new ratings. Well, what's the difference? They're just still releasing patches and... I don't know, they came out with Service Pack 2. They're doing a little bit better, but I don't know. As another article we'll talk about a little bit later, using some of the benefits of Linux, putting that into Longhorn. It's going to be like Microsoft Linux, kind of. But
interesting.
So that's what that report has to say. As I fumble around.
Yeah, you're good at that.
Yes. I want this to be in PlayStation 3. Sony Invention Beam Sights and Sounds into the Brain.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of a Matrix-y kind of thing. If you think video games are engrossing now, just wait. PlayStation maker Sony Corp has been granted a patent for beaming sensory information directly into the brain. The technique could one day be used to create video games in which you can smell, taste, and touch, or to help people who are deaf and blind. Or for people looking to brainwash people. No, it did say that. The U.S. patent granted for Sony researcher Thomas Dawson describes a technique for aiming ultrasonic pulses at specific areas of the brain to induce sensory experiences such as smell, sounds, and images.
And I wonder how many brains they've fried experimenting with that. It's like, we need to turn down the frequency on that one.
Yeah.
Write another one.
Actually, they haven't done any experiments yet. The pulsed ultrasonic signal alters the neural timing of the cortex. The patent states, no invasive surgery is needed to assist a person, such as a blind person, to view, live, and or record images or hear sounds. According to New Science magazine, the first report on the patent Sony's technique could be an improvement over an existing non-surgical method known as transcriptional magnetic stimulation. This activates nerves using rapidly changing magnetic fields, but cannot be focused on small groups of brain cells. Niels Birbaumer, a neuroscientist at the University of Tübingen in Germany, told New Scientist he had looked at the Sony patent and found it plausible. Birmingham himself has developed a device that enables disabled people to communicate by reading their brain waves. Cool.
Ooh.
Sony Electronics.
Actually, does he live in his mother's basement?
Dude, he lives in his mother's basement.
Oh, okay.
The Sony Electronics spokesman told the magazine that no experiments had been conducted and that the patent was based on an inspiration that may someday be the direction that technology will take us.
Yeah, well, of course, the Matrix is, the epitome of where we're really trying to go with the technology.
Of course.
So, that's just one more step into that, plugging ourselves in. Which I think is, it's a good goal, but we need to take that, with our eyes wide open.
I hope it never happens in my lifetime.
Actually, it would be really cool is to have it, completely functional, like completely know it, and then die right afterwards. So then you're done. You don't really have to deal with it anymore.
Deal with what?
With the repercussions of what will occur. Yeah. To experience being able to be plugged in into a completely different reality. And then you die, and then, don't have to worry about the real repercussions of it all.
VR, have you been smoking that new chronic that they're selling here in Arizona? No, I just heard on the news today, actually, that they're selling a type of chronic that's 10 times more potent than the current marijuana in Arizona.
Yeah, is it called Jimson weed?
No.
Okay.
And it's being sold in where? Where do we say? Scottsdale? And then North Paradise Valley? Where all the rich kids are.
Oh, yeah, they got some money to pop down on the real good chronic.
They're like, dude, can I get some Doja? My dad just gave me a big-ass allowance, man.
I need to blow it real quick.
And I'm driving his car tonight. Yes! All right. So,
which is funny, if you just, do the same thing with Jimson weed, it's, 50 times more potent.
Wow.
Yeah.
We have to do a show on Jimson weed.
Yeah.
Okay, and as we bounce around from topic to topic to topic, because that's what we do here, on the In-N-Out Show, this is kind of interesting. I believe it was the last show, we talked about doing processing through light and fiber optics, stuff like that, because the bandwidth, the amount of information you send through light is quite a bit. But there's also, it's hard to build, photonic type stuff on a small scale like they can with current chip design and stuff like that. You have to build the device that sends the light and receives it and, all this stuff. So it
modulates it.
Modulates it and consumabilizes it and, But anyways, no, to get to the real meat of it, that they feel that they've kind of solved this problem a little bit by using plasmonics.
Plasmonics?
Plasmonics, you say?
Wait, let me get this. It's something very similar. Is they're using superheated gases to modulate
light. Don't talk about what you do in the bathroom, dude. every time VR is in there, it's like there's a shower of lights. No, I'm just joking. Okay, no. Basically, a new research group in Stanford School of Engineering is pioneering just such a technology that can bridge lights and, you know, kind of typical electronics into plasmonics.
That just sounds screwy. Plasmonics.
Do you think the guys that invented this wear bras in their heads? And also invented, like, a woman.
And smoking that really good chronic.
Yeah. No, seriously, it's a real story. It's not an April Fool's story. Surface plasmons are density waves of electrons. Picture bunches of electrons passing a point regularly along the surface of a metal. Plasmons have the same frequencies and electromagnetic fields as light, but their subwavelength size means they take up less space. Plasmonics then is the technology of transmitting these light-like waves along nanoscale wires.
Okay.
With every wave, you can, in principle, carry information, says Mark Brongersma, assistant professor of material science and engineering, and head of the new plasmonics multidisciplinary university research initiative, MRI. Say that one more time. Multidisciplinary university research initiative. Which earlier this month received an additional $300,000 round of funding from the Air Force Office of Sponsored Research, AFOSR. Good people over at AFOSR.
That's right.
Plasmon.
You're giving shout out to OSR.
AFO.
Whatever it is.
Serbrud Murray. And AFO, sir. Plasmon waves are interesting because they are optical frequencies. The higher the frequency of the wave, the more information you can transport. Optical frequency is about 100,000 times greater than the frequency of today's electronic microprocessors.
So would you really, really make, you know, like, I've got a big old red flag going out? Because how do you go with, like, sending electrons against a metal surface creates a frequency that is 100 times higher, 100,000 times higher than what is usually done with electrons going down wires?
Well, it's different.
Really?
So you're understanding.
Really slow.
Yeah.
It's different.
It's supported by a $2.3 million grant.
Oh, that's the main difference right there. It's supported by a $2.3 million grant.
Received last October from the AFOSR. The goal of
that.
We're just butchering this whole thing. The goal of the MURI, the M-U-R-I, sounds like an alien race, is to demonstrate plasmonics in action on a silicone, standard silicone chip. Brongersma, poor kid, and about 20 MURI partners, including people that I'm not going to read, in electro, blah, 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 have made working plasma components and have had their first journal article expected for publication upcoming issue of Optic Letters. Next act will be integrate the components into an electron chip to demonstrate plasmonic data generation, transportation, and detection. Success will be the first of its kind anywhere. Plasmons are generally generated under the right conditions. Light strikes a metal. The electro field of the light jiggles the electrons on the metal to the light frequencies, setting off density waves of electrons.
Okay, now I understand.
The process is analogous to how the vibrations of the larynx jiggle molecules in the air into density waves experience the sound. Plasmon waves behave on metals much like light waves behind a glass, meaning that plasmonic engineers can employ all the same ingenious tricks, such as multiplexing, sending multiple waves, that photonic engineers can use to cram more data down a cable.
But yeah, they can also do a whole lot of interesting, like, Fourier analysis. And oh, wow, that's really nifty.
Yeah. Meanwhile, because plasmonic components can be crafted from the same materials chipmakers use today, Stanford engineers are hopeful that they can make all devices need to route light around a processor or any other kind of chip. This would include plasmon sources, detectors, and wires, which the lab has already made, as well as splitters and even transistors. While on all plasmonic chips might be feasible someday, Brongersma expects that they, in the near term, plasmonic wires like this high traffic freeways on chips and otherwise conventional electronics, with otherwise conventional electronics, local arrays of electronic transistors would carry out the switching necessary for computation. But when a lot of data exceeds, NOAA needs an express lane to travel from one section of the chip to another, Electron bits could be converted to plasmon waves, sent along a plasmonic wire, and converted back into electronic bits at their destination.
That's really cool. That's I like the analogous to speakers like that.
Yeah?
Yeah, that was pretty nifty. Good little innovation there. That's why they're the interdisciplinary research...
And they rock! I'm just kidding, I had to say that. Okay, and also our list of cities out there has increased for free wireless access coverage to Dayton City.
Is that Ohio?
Yep. Dayton City Commission approved testing new wireless fidelity services in a limited test area over the next few months before deciding to pursue an expansion of the technology citywide. The move makes Daytona the first city in Ohio to initiate citywide edge-to-edge Wi-Fi coverage. Daytona has also become the first city nationally to offer public-private partnership Wi-Fi model that is not funded by taxpayers and comes at no charge to the end user. In addition to offering internet services for free to the residents and visitors, I am excited about the economic development opportunities this new venture presents. This type of technology asset will help attract businesses and workers interested in the open development. The open environment Dayton will offer this has long-term implications for Dayton's continued growth as a center for technology and innovation. We want to position this city for everyone that may benefit from this technology. We are not talking about a hotspot here, but rather a hot city.
A hot city.
Don't you love that? Gosh, I got a good one for you in your speech. Say hot city.
Wow, now that's a great buzzword.
Hot city. Welcome to Daytona. Or Dayton. Dayton, Ohio. The hot city.
Yeah, that's, you know, that.
What's the weather there?
Cold. And probably a little humid.
But now it's hot.
Yeah, so it probably gets a little muggy in the summer.
All right.
Yeah, so I think, like, Phoenix should sue them and go, no, we're the hot city. You need to sit down and...
back up.
And chill out.
Triple B.I. All right. Okay, well, speaking of evil... Well, we spoke about it.
Is this about Microsoft?
Nope.
There's a bigger evil.
Well, speaking of spamming and cookies and spyware and...
Oh, okay, that stuff.
And... stuff like that that just turns your computer into sort of a machine where you do your work and surf the web and play games and watch porn. It's now a device
which I have to organize and delete and keep control of. And yeah, that's really all.
Name properly.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. But anyways, no. Basically. Turning your machine into, an advertising terminal, a statistics gathering bot, all that stuff.
It's a Nelson machine for everyday living.
Yeah. So basically, this article kind of goes on to say that, you know, users are getting more knowledgeable about cookies a little bit. Talking about, you know, little files that are stored in your computer that store information about some stuff on the internet. Also, there's some programs out there that automatically will delete your cookies after a certain period of time. Some spyware programs, even some antivirus programs are kind of integrating everything into all in one solution will go out and also end up deleting, you know, your cookies at a specified time. Well, there is a company that's finding a way to get around you, cookie deleters.
Oh. Get caught in my, you know, proverbial hand in the cookie jar again.
Oh, God. How long were you waiting to insert that? You were waiting for a while.
No, actually, that just came out. Okay. It really did.
Okay.
It's like when you got around, you know, the cookie deleters, it was like eaters, and, okay, they were, yeah, it was just perfect.
All right.
And now the whole thing's just done.
That's awesome. United Viralities is offering online makers or marketers and publishers technology that attempts to undermine the growth trend among consumers to delete cookies planted in their computers. The New York company unveiled what is called as PIE, or Persistent Identification Element, a technology that's uploaded to a browser and restores deleted cookies. In addition, PIE, which can't be easily removed, can also act as a cookie backup since it contains the same information. According to Jupiter Research, a division of Jupiter Media Corp, 50% of internet users have deleted the tiny files, essentially making many consumers anonymous during site visits. In addition, 39% of the customers are deleting cookies from their primary computer monthly. United Virtuality's PIE helps combat this consumer behavior. By leveraging a feature in FlashMX called Local Shared Objects. FlashMX is a Macromedia Incorporated company application for developing multimedia web content using user interfaces and web applications. The technology runs on a flash player that the company says deployed on 98% of the internet-capable computers. When a consumer goes to a PIE-enabled website, the visitor's browser is tagged with a flash object that contains a unique identification similar to the text found in a traditional cookie. In this way, PIE acts as a cookie backup, can also restore the original cookie when the consumer visits the site. All consumers have learned to delete cookies. Most are unaware of shared objects and don't know how to disable them. Mookie Tenenbaum, founder of the and chief executive of United Virtualities. Mookie, love you.
Yeah, I love that.
That's got to be a fake name, man, I'm telling you.
No, he's probably, what's it?
Hiding from people who are going to look.
No, he's probably actually about, 35, because that was about the time where, the whole, that kind of movement went on.
Mookie?
Yeah.
The Mookie movement?
The Mookie movement.
Says that the company is trying to help them, by preventing them from deleting cookies that help website operators deliver better services. This is thanks, Mook.
Yeah, really. This is any web any service has ever been better because they had a cookie.
We'd like to give the Mook of the Award a year to Mook.
We just created the Mook Award.
And we're giving it to Mook. First person, first day. The user is not proficient enough in technology to know if the cookie is good or bad or how it works.
Yeah, I feel really, really degraded now, too. Mookie just thinks so high of himself and so low.
He's Mookie, man. Mookie rules.
Oh, yeah, he's got the Mook Award.
You know...
My bad. I'm going to go sit over here in my corner and...
yeah.
Think about, figuring out that I might have to, delete my cookies and not just eat them, too.
Yeah, you know what? Consumers have chosen to remove their cookies because they don't want their cookies. For whatever reason
they want to toss their cookies, all right? Just let them toss them.
And that's completely up to them. So if they want to toss their cookies, then why don't we just let them toss their cookies?
That's right. It's that's your personal choice.
Okay, well, what you can do...
It's not internet bulimia, okay? It's okay to toss your cookies.
Yeah. There is a way to combat against Mookie and his PIE program. And basically that is to change your settings on your Flash player to not allow shared objects. And if you want to get a link to where you can see how to do that, I'm going to put that on the site. So, you'll see it in the show notes, and it's just go over to Macromedia's website, and it has all the information on the privacy settings and what you can do. Just basically raise them to, the highest. This is the way how you do it, is that you put your shared objects, tells you how much space you have allotted on your system for them, and I just change that to zero. And, I kind of just put the highest settings and everything else just to see what gets blocked, just for fun. So, but check that out, and that will be on
the
website.
And we can call that Mookieism.
Yeah.
Is the anti-shared object movement.
That's
Mookieism.
That's right.
You heard it here in Define First on In the Now.
On In the Now. Bringing such... such, you know, important things.
Well, important lexicon into the technology world. It's absolutely necessary to have Mookieisms now.
Of course. Because you may be mooked. Okay. All right. Well, moving right along to another article. We have talked here on the show about black holes quite a bit. I don't profess to be a mathematician enough to, you know, really go and delve deep into black holes and their plausibility or whatnot. But I do like to talk about some of those science articles and things that have to do with black holes from time to time. Basically here, it says that black holes don't exist. This one scientist, and he gives his take on what they are or what people perceive black holes to be.
All right, let's hear this one.
All right. And he said, too, because I guess he said, well, this is what he says. He said, Einstein didn't really believe in black holes. And he says...
And how does he know what Einstein believed?
Well, Einstein told a lot of stuff about what he believed. But, you know, I don't know what Einstein's exact belief is on black holes. But let's get into the article. Let me give you some details.
All right.
Black holes are staples of science fiction, and many think astronomers have observed them indirectly. But according to a physicist at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, these awesome breaches in space-time do not, and indeed cannot, exist. Over the past few years, observations of the motions of galaxies have shown that some 70% of the universe seems to be compressed of a strange dark matter, or dark energy, that has driven the universe's accelerated expansion. George Chaplin thinks that the collapse of the massive stars, which has long believed to generate black holes, actually leads to the formation of stars that contain dark energy. It's a near certainty that black holes don't exist, he claims.
So black holes don't exist. Black matter doesn't, or dark matter doesn't exist.
No, he says dark matter does exist.
Oh, but well, I thought he was talking about dark energy.
Well, he was talking about dark energy.
Okay.
I said dark matter. But it's dark energy. Hold on. However, as long as the 1975 quantum physicists argued that the strange things that do happen in the event horizon, matter governed by quantum laws becomes hypersensitive to slight disturbances, the result was quickly forgotten, says Chaplin, because it didn't agree with the prediction of the general relativity, but actually it was absolutely correct. This strange behavior, and he's talking about when a star collapses, the strange behavior, he says, is the signature of a quantum phase transition of space-time. Chaplin argues that the star doesn't simply collapse to form a black hole. Instead, the space-time inside it becomes filled with dark energy, and this has some intriguing gravitational effects. Outside the surface of the dark energy star, it behaves much like a black hole, producing a strong gravitational tug, but inside, the negative gravity of the dark energy may cause matter to bounce back out again. If the dark energy star is big enough, Chaplin predicts any electrons bounced out will have been converted to positrons, which then annihilate other electrons in a burst of high-energy radiation. Chaplin says that this could explain the radiation observed from the center of our galaxy, previously interpreted as a signature of a huge black hole. He also thinks that the universe could be filled with primordial dark energy stars. These are formed not by stellar collapses, but by fluctuations of space-time itself, like blobs of liquid condensed spontaneously out of a cooling gas. These, he suggests, could be stuff that has the same gravitational effect as normal matter, but cannot be seen, the elusive substance known as dark matter.
You know, what kind of occurred to me about halfway through that is he knows an awful lot about what goes on in a dark energy star, when we've never seen one, observed one, or been able to experiment on one. Really kind of interesting. He seems rather clairvoyant in this matter.
Okay.
And so, yet I have... It's a good hypothesis. Really good. But now, if there's really all this dark energy stars that are roaming around the universe, why don't we see more evidence of them? Well, we've never seen dark matter. We've never seen any, you know, evidence of dark matter except for the acceleration of the universe. That's what, you know, that's the reason why the idea of dark matter came about. dark energy have no idea where that came about except for maybe a spinoff of dark matter. So, you know, this whole thing about it having these great effects on the universe, well, I have a hard time seeing that because the only, you know, how those ideas were even spun were off of one interesting, you know, actually, an interesting unexplained phenomenon in the universe, which was the acceleration of an expanding universe, which is counterintuitive and should be mutually exclusive because it's expanding and accelerating and cooling. It just doesn't make much sense. So that was the theory on how to explain that, but yet it doesn't. And so I'm done.
You know, they had Mr. Science on Coast to Coast AM radio like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
That was good.
Who's Mr. Science?
Mr. Wizard.
Oh, I thought he was... He's still alive?
He's still alive, dude.
My God, he was ancient when I was young.
Yeah.
Well, that's all that science, baby. It's kept him alive.
So, yeah. So that's the...
He's like Darth Vader.
Oh, God. Actually, he didn't sound too bad on the phone.
I'm Mr. Wizard.
Yeah. We're in our own world.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so that is another perspective on what those phenomena are out there. Okay, also, let's see. I watched a little ad for this. This is kind of interesting. Hitachi claims a leap in drive density. Now, I can explain this article very, very fast, actually. Okay, in a hard drive, right? You put a little bit on there. Store a few bits. And bits usually lay flat, like an X and a Y. And, you know, obviously there's some depth to them. But they lay the bits flat. And they found out that if you put the bits up on their side...
Like how they bury people in Holland?
Yeah. Then you fit more bits on the hard drive.
Wow, that's an amazing, amazing innovation. I can't believe they didn't think of that earlier.
Well, maybe they couldn't put it together, I don't know.
Okay.
Hitachi Global Storage will come with hard drives containing 230 gigabits of data per square inch. Square inch.
Wow.
The companies expect to announce on a day that's passed. What could mean a 20 gigabyte iPod mini? The density breakthrough represents a refinement in perpendicular recording. Hard drives record and store data in a longitudinal fashion, with the read and write heads scanning over a horizontal plane. In perpendicular recording, data bits are aligned vertically, allowing for more data to be squeezed into a finite area. Put another way, they will go from being stored in two-dimensional XY grid to living in a three-dimensional XYZ space. We're redesigning the head and disk quite significantly, said Bill Healy, Senior Vice President of Product Strategy and Marketing at Hitachi. Hey, an American name over there. All we have done is longitudinal recording and hard drives since the 1950s. Hitachi will actually come out with drives that employ perpendicular recording techniques towards the end of this year, but the first drives won't be nearly as dense, holding around 130 gigabits. 250 gigabits per square inch, and will mostly serve as traditional technology. He said longitudinal recording drives are expected to top out 120 gigabits per square inch. Top out. So the top says 230. That's when I was reading the article before. I wasn't quite sure. Okay, well, widespread commercial development and perpendicular drives will occur with the 230 gigabit per square inch drives in 2007. He said technology will allow Hitachi to come out with a 20-gigabyte micro drive, which has a diameter of 1 inch, and a 3.5-inch drive for PCs, and digital video recorders will hold a terabyte. That's quite a bit.
Wow. That's a lot.
I still don't understand how hard drives read and store data on a gig disk. I mean, man, how do they go around and find the exact little spots and go... like that. Find the exact spots and read it. I just...
Yeah, and if it knows where to go, why does it need the little bit that it needs to read. Doesn't it already know what's there?
Well, I think knowing where to go is probably
a whole lot less than reading a couple bits there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I talked to somebody that works with an eye doctor, and they told me, she told me, that they could do eye transplants. I don't know if that's real or not.
You know what? I've seen a lot of stuff, like they've done like lens transplants. I don't know about cornea. I really doubt that, because that's just a big old nerve bundle. We have a hard time dealing with nerves still.
Yeah, she goes, we could transplant a whole eye. And I'm like, so you can just give blind people eyes and they can see again? She's like, yeah.
No. No, so, not going to. No.
Yeah. So the one thing that I did read that made me think, well, what she said must not be true, because this thing is a much crappier version of what she's talking about, and they've invented this. It's called the bionic eye. Well, that's what the article calls it. I'm sure the doctors call it much different. U.S. scientists have designed a bionic eye to allow blind people to see again. It comprises a computer chip that sits in the back of the individual's eye, linked to a mini video camera built into glasses that they wear. Images captured by the camera are beamed to the chip, which translate them into impulses that the brain can interpret. The device has been designed by Professor Ghislain Dagnelli at Johns Hopkins University, Baltimore. Professor Dagnelli unveiled details at the Royal National Institute for the Blind Conference in London, UK. Human trials will begin within a year. Although the images produced by the artificial eye were far from perfect, they could be clear enough to allow someone who was otherwise blind to recognize faces, he said. The breakthrough is likely to benefit patients with the most common cause of blindness, macular degeneration, which affects 500,000 people in the UK. This occurs when there is damage to the macula, which is a central part of the retina where light is focused and changed into nerve signals in the middle of the brain. The implant bypasses the disease cells in the retina and stimulates the remaining viable cells. Professor said the retina implant contains tiny electrodes. If you stimulate a single electrode, the person will see a single dot of light. They have already tested implants containing a handful of electrodes, but the end device will contain 50 to 100 to give an exact, to a better overall picture. We're hoping this will be enough for the person to be able to make their way through a building, find a door or window, and avoid obstacles, for example. To us, the images look very basic, but for someone who was previously blind, they are a massive step forward. He added, there's still quite a bit of work that will be needed to fine-tune it. Being able to see the faces is not quite, will be quite a bit down the line. He said, training the individual to learn how to interpret the blurry images should help. Neil Lifestone of RNIB said, it's a revolutionary piece of technology and really has the potential to change people's lives. We need to be aware it is still some way in the future. So you only get 50 to 100 points of light?
Well, you know
it. It's better than nothing.
Yeah, if you lived in complete darkness, that's a whole lot of, that's 100 new reference points of your world. That's amazing.
I'm trying to figure out how they, what that would look like. What?
Well, it'd probably be kind of like pixels on the, on your on the computer screen.
Yeah, but see, if you had like, you know, like, see this whole screen, you have like 50 or whatever, or 100. You're like, what the hell's going on? I still don't know what the hell's going on. Because it might be objects hidden in between.
Yeah, but they're probably, you know, different colors.
Move the head around.
Yeah. Then you get different reference points. I saw about 20 years ago that they had this thing that they were putting on your back and kind of did that same thing as it was, it would, you know those things with the pins that you, like, put your hand on and it makes an impression on your hand?
Uh-huh.
They were doing that on the back. So you could actually kind of, like, feel what you're seeing in front of you.
I think we talked about that.
Yeah, it was pretty nifty. That's old stuff.
We've talked about so many things.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that video that VR's in out there on the internet. No, just kidding.
That's why I have it on mute. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah. Now, we talked a lot about blogging and stuff like that before. This is kind of interesting. We even talked about people that didn't like a particular company and set up a website like Verizon Sucks or whatever, you know. This guy didn't like his hair transplant, and he got their the domain name for the company, pretty much. They didn't register a domain name.
Uh-huh.
So it's BosleyMedical.com.
Really?
So he bought it, and he's talking about how much he hates them. And they tried to go after him for it, and court said no, he didn't do anything wrong. California man can disparage a hair restoration company on a website using the company's name without violating copyright law, an appeals court ruled. Bosley Medical Institute in Seattle sued former client Michael Krimmer after he created a website in 2000 in a bald-faced effort to get even.
That's funny.
With the company. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said Krimmer said he was unhappy with the outcome of his hair restoration. Dude, if Donald Trump can't get his hair to look right, and he's a billionaire, do you think you can? Come on.
That's a good point.
Seriously. Dude, just come on. Just leave it alone. Yeah, and he said he'd be unhappy with the outcome of his hair restoration. Use the company's name, the website address, BosleyMedical.com. The company claimed his use of the name was trademark infringement, but the appeals court disagreed, saying the website was not created to make a profit. Or to confuse Bosley's customers and potential clients, there were no links on the website, on the site, to other hair restoration providers, the court noted. Krimmer's attorney Paul Levy said, "The decision is an important victory for free speech on the Internet. It makes clear that consumers can use a trade name for a company that they want to criticize." The appeals court, however, reinstated part of the lawsuit in which Bosley alleged that Krimmer is violating a so-called cybersporting law by allegedly attempting to sell the site to Bosley in exchange for removing the disparaging material. Bosley's attorneys did not return phone calls seeking comment.
Yeah, that's kind of like extortion.
Yeah. And they also could say he did say that, but he really didn't, so they can get some money out of him or something. You know what I mean? Who knows? You know,
yeah.
Where's the real proof at? Who's the real people? Okay, look, I'm going to save that one for last.
Ooh, that must be really good.
It's pretty good. It's about sex with donkeys.
Ah, yeah, that's why you like it.
No, just joking. Japan unveils a plan to send humans to the moon. Now, this plan's quite a bit off. But, you know, they're working on it. Japan's space agency mapped out a new ambitious plan for manned flights to the moon by 2025 as the first step to explore the solar system's far-flung planets, but said decisions about whether it would go it alone or collaborate with other nations won't be made for another decade. The proposal unveiled by Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA, marks the agent's first attempt in years to rethink its mission and rejuvenate a space program that was that's been a hobby by recent launch pad and space probe failures. JAXA sent the plan to the government space plan panel for review, asking for a budget increase to roughly $2.6 billion a year from $2 billion. By comparison, NASA annual budget, $16.2 billion. Until now, the question has been, can Japan develop its own manned spaceship? Why not? They make everything else.
Yeah.
We will know the answer in another 10 years when the agency will review its options. JAXA Chairman Kenji Chachikawa, I know I said that right, said it won't be required. It's kind of fun figuring out Asian names and saying them right.
Yes. So
you're like, yes, I said that. Because it even sounds cool when you're done. It won't require a big budget rise, he said, adding that it's too soon to know how it will cost because things might change in coming years. Japan's long-term vision, you know, like fighting North Korea. Japan's long-term vision resembles those of President Bush and European space officials who hope to land astronauts and robots on the moon as the first step to sending space shuttle missions to Mars. Over the next decade, JAXA's plans for scientists to develop robots and nanotechnology for the surveys on the moon and could design a rocket and space vessel capable of carrying cargo and passengers. By 2015, JAXA will review whether it's ready to pour resources into manned space travel and possibly building a base on the moon. The decision to possibly try for Mars and other planets would be after 2005. A lot of possibilities in there.
Well, yeah, they need to because they do want to go and they need to acquire more land and room and food.
Yeah. The plan emerges 2 months after JAXA sent a communication satellite into the space board the country's workhorse H-2A rocket, its first successful launch since November 2003, when a rocket carrying two spy satellites malfunctioned after liftoff and was destroyed in mid-flight. That accident had forced officials to put the entire space program temporarily on hold. It also marks a major policy shift that was set in motion last year when a Japanese government panel recommended that the agency focus on manned space flight instead of unmanned scientific probes.
Huh.
Should go for the gold.
Yeah.
Also, they're saying that JAXA officials hope to establish a base on the moon that they could mine resources found on and under the lunar surface. An illustration handout showed an astronaut directing an array of robots constructing the base, which would draw solar panel power from photovoltaic panels and explore the moon's poles for traces of water to converge to hydrogen fuel.
Hmm. Well, there's a lot of, I believe that there's actually a lot of magnesium on the moon, which is actually a really good energy source.
You know, just popped in my head. I remember reading an article today. They put a Wi-Fi hotspot on the North Pole so Santa can get on the web.
Right on.
Yeah, it's up there. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, like Santa really needs... Yeah, there's a whole... Well, actually, you know, that'd save a lot of postage.
Save a lot of postage? Yeah, it would.
Just have to email Santa.
He uses Gmail because he has all that space. You know, here, look at this guy on the right. On the left. Does he look like a movie star? I've seen a guy in a movie that looks just like him.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He's an FBI agent, but there's a guy that looks just like him and plays in the movies.
And he probably plays an FBI agent.
Yeah. That's probably his brother. At a recent Information Systems Security Association meeting in Los Angeles, a team of FBI agents demonstrated current web cracking techniques and broke a 128-bit web key in about 3 minutes.
Wow.
Special Agent Geoff Bickers ran the PowerPoint presentation and explained the attack, while the other agents, who did not want to be named or photographed, did the dirty work of sniffing wireless traffic and breaking web keys. Basically, this kind of article talks about, mentions what web is and what the key is, and for those of you that don't know, excuse me, web is an algorithm used to encrypt the traffic that goes over wireless networks. It's got inherent vulnerabilities, yada, yada, yada. There's software out there that cracks it. And this article talks about kind of what they did. And actually, they're going to talk about the first wave of web cracking. Fast forward to last summer, when the first of the latest generation of web cracking tools appeared. This current generation uses a combination of statistical techniques focused on unique IVs, those are initialization vectors, captured and brute force dictionary attacks to break 128-bit web keys in minutes instead of hours. Now, Special Agent Bickner noted, it doesn't matter if you use 128-bit web keys, you are vulnerable. And what they did here, let's see, they put a Netgear access point up. They used fake AP to broadcast all these fake access points. Basically, they started capturing packets from their target, which was this Netgear access point that had web on it. And they started converting it into a PCAP format. This type of format be read by the PCAP and I think Etherrail. These PCAP files will then be processed by their programs. Many programs, both commercial and open source, can be used to capture packets, but the two favorites seem to be Kismet or AeroDump, now part of the AirCrack. Ideally, one laptop should be scanning while another laptop will be running an attack, which is what the FBI team did. Now, the FBI team forced the access point to generate packets in order for it to read some more packets and get a web key, and they used some tools to do that. The FBI team used the DAW feature in Void 11 to repeatedly disassociate the laptop from the access point Desired additional traffic was then generated as Windows XP tried to reassociate back with the AP. Note that this was not a particularly stealthy attack, but the laptop user will notice a series of wireless network unavailable notifications in the taskbar of the desktop screen. Another attack method the FBI team used is a replay attack. The basic premise of the replay attack is to capture at least one packet traveling from the victim's laptop to the victim's access point. This packet can then be replayed into the network, causing target IP to respond and provide more traffic to capture. So it's sending an already encrypted packet, and it's just sending it out there. It doesn't know how to decrypt it, but it just sends it to get a response. It just keeps back and forth and generating more traffic as this capture of files of data is being captured, and then they're going to crack it. AirPlay, also part of AirCrack, can perform a replay attack against a based on captured ARP, Address Resolution Protocol packets, which are broadcast at regular intervals in wire and wireless networks and are easy to spot. AirPlay automatically scans a captured PCAP file, pulls up the suspected ARP packets, and replays them to the access point. About after 3 minutes of capturing and cracking, the FBI team found the correct web key and displayed it on the projected notebook screen. Agent Bickner, still speaking to the audience, turned around, looking at the screen, and was surprised. It usually takes 5 to 10 minutes. So that was a big day for them. Now, what they say is countermeasures that you can do. They said this is not the official FBI countermeasures, but here's what you can do. Network segregation. Put your access point on a separate subnet with the firewall separating the wireless and internal users. Change the default settings on your access point. Default settings like the SSID. Excuse me. Long day. SSID, administrator password, channel are well known, if not even included as part of some WLAN attack tools. Use WPA with a strong key. WPA is a definite improvement over WAP in providing wireless security, but the version intended for home and SOHO users uses WPA PSK. It has a weakness shared by any passphrase security mechanism. The choice of simple, common, and short passphrases may allow you, your WPA protected WLAN to be quickly compromised via dictionary attack. Update your firmware. This is helpful if your AP or client doesn't currently support WPA. Many manufacturers have newer firmware for H.211G products that add WPA support. You may also find this for the H.211B gear, but it's not as common check anyways. And the thing you do is turn off your WLAN when it's not in use. A $5 lamp timer from your local hardware store is a simple but effective way to keep your WLAN or LAN from being harmed while you're sleeping. So it turns off, turn off. Bickner's also said that if you have access, you have an access point that can swap keys fast enough, you may be able to stay ahead of an attacker. Most likely you'll get bored and attack someone else. Or most likely they will get bored and attack somebody else. But for most WLAN owners, this method isn't practical. The FBI demonstration demonstrated this attack to the computer security professionals at the ISSA meeting in order to show the inadequate protection offered by WEP. It is one thing to read stories of WEP being broken in minutes, but it is shocking to see the attack done right before your eyes. It was fast and simple.
Wow.
So...
Well, yeah, you know, 3 minutes is... That's pretty damn fast.
Yeah. All your web are belong to the feds. So. All right. Well, I think that that's going to do it for our show.
That's good. They, you know, leave us in a little bit of fear.
Fear.
Yeah. Yes. Great motivator there.
So, yeah, check that out. Check out the article. You see it on there. See some of the tools that they use. Go ahead and play around with them and see how secure your network is. How bad it is. I might actually do some things here on my own. Might play around with some stuff, try to make my network a little bit better. But, all right, well, I think that's do it for me.
Yeah, I think I'm done.
Done. Put a fork in them.
Yeah, put some butter on me. I'm toast.
All right. Well, this is Slip Mode signing out. Check out the forums. Send email. Post anything. Keep it going. Show's going, and we're continuing to put up episodes. So this is Slipboat signing out.
This is VR saying later.
And we'll see you soon. See ya.